You're listening to a Hebrew in Israel podcast with Yoel Halevi, exploring the language, culture, and history of the Bible. For more information, visit us at HebrewInIsrael.net.
Now, the first couple of verses we have here are very, very, very difficult. This is a very weird story. There's no clear explanation what on earth is going on with this story. It's unclear. It's very difficult. I mean, I sat down to try to build up an explanation. I had to use several commentaries and kind of glue and paste the different sections to try to explain this. There's also a debate here. First of all, we need to understand that there's a connection between verse 25 and verse 26, that the words of Tzipora were probably broken down. There might be an incantation here that she might be saying. This is, as I said, a very, very strange section in the Torah in general. And we need to also understand that there's a certain demonic element here as well. I want to read something out of a book that I have here. So this might be a bit of a long read, but this is a painfully long read. Okay. So first of all, there's an interesting thing that he points out here. He says, It says in verse 19, all the men who wanted to kill you are dead. So the commentator says, this suggests that Moses is now free to leave his place of asylum and make his return. So this, by the way, connects to what Rick said, all the way back then. Actually, let's stop the sharing for a moment. See me. Okay. So if it says the following, so this actually connects to something that Rick said, about Moses feeling guilty and so on. So it actually kind of fits in a little bit to that. So this suggests that Moses is now free to leave the place of asylum and make his return, yet God still attacks him. So some people say this is the reason why he's attacked you. The idea may be that even though Moses is free in a legal sense to return, he still carries about on his person a kind of spiritual religious pollution as a result of the homicide. A pollution that must be purged. In the case of homicide, the pollution is referred to by Hebrew as dam. So this connects to the whole fact that she uses the term chatan damim, a bridegroom of blood. This is where Tzipora act of circumcision becomes important. It appears to function as the expiation, purging, atonement for the guilt pollution of blood. It's another thing that he points out here. And then he also says that we find circumcision as a way of removing pollution from the Phoenician story about Cronos, who circumcises himself and the people with him to try to appease his father, who is about to devour Uranus, who is about to devour the world. And he also says, thus, the touching of his son's bloody foreskin to Moses, Moses' own genitalia, the Hebrew word for feet, can sometimes be a euphemism for sex organs, may have functioned as a symbolic circumcision and produce the required expiratory effect. So this might explain what she was doing. Now, there's another explanation that derives the idea from some demonic attacks. Now, a demonic attack is a little strange, but I'm going to translate what they say here in Hebrew. Many of the new commentators point out the demonic nature of the story, and they're not really debating only just on the details. However, it seems to be that the idea here of the blood groom is not an invention of the modern research, and already appears in rabbinic midrashim. And there's some places where it points out, and so on. So the question is, what do we find in the ancient world? And what we find in the ancient world is the idea that we find demons that sometimes swallow people up all the way to their belly button or their genitalia. And there was a way of diffusing it. So they said in Arsalan Tash, which is in Syria, two inscriptions, two in Phoenician inscriptions, incantations, were found on a chalk plates. One big one, small, from the 7th century. And both of them, we have drawings of demons which swallow a person up all the way to his private parts. Now, the other thing that seems to appear here is that what she's doing is an... it's called apotropos. Was it called in English? It means to take possession, protection of someone. And what it seems to be, based on what we also know from the Sumerian culture, is that there were incantations that people would say when they would go on a journey through a desert. So having all these little details connected to one another, it seems to be that what she was doing was a protection incantation that might be connected to the fact that he murdered someone, so he still needs to be punished in some way. Tzipora circumcises her own son, and we have to understand that also in the ancient world, circumcising someone was also a way of accepting someone as a member of family. So the circumcision was a protective concept. When you circumcise someone in a certain ceremony, they now are placed into that family and therefore under that family's protection. So she took that idea of protection, circumcised her own son. Raises the question, why aren't the children of Moses circumcised? And the answer is probably because in Egypt, the Israelites didn't circumcise, or that he wasn't fully aware of who he was. Again, another paradox, another question that we're not too sure what the answer is. She throws it onto Abraham, onto Moses, there's blood on it, which can be a protective element, and it diffuses the whole situation. However, we still don't have a clear answer why this whole thing actually happens. The only answer I could find was that, one interpretation says because they were in the desert, it was a demonic attack, but the verse actually says that God attacked him. So some people, as we said, some people say it's connected to the fact that he murdered, so there's a punishment that has to be here. Some people, there's a midrash that says that he was punished because he didn't circumcise his son. That seems to be a bit more of throwing backwards based on details of latter details where circumcision is considered to be a very, very important deed, though it should be also a very important deed amongst the Israelites at the time. But as I said, this is a very, very peculiar story here. And I think the only thing that we don't necessarily find here is the concept of why was he attacked, unless we say the following, that the Bible clearly does believe in demons, okay, and that there are demonic powers and so on, and Moses was attacked by one of them, and we're just telling us a side story here that God, that saying a demon attacked him, but the demon attacked him only through the authority of God sending him. But why God sent him is still remains in a question mark. If anyone has any ideas, please comment. We will continue, and we will talk about this when I see the comments. So I'm going back to sharing. So it says, Vayhi baderech b'malon. It was on the way at the place of rest, because the malon comes from the word lun, which is to sleep, to rest. Vayifgasheu Adonai, and the Lord came across him. Vayivakesh hamito, and he wanted to kill him. So verse 25 says, Vatikach tziporatzo. Tzipora took flint. Now, why flint? The ancient tradition was to circumcise with flint. If you want to do it exactly as it is in biblical times, you would use a flint knife. What's very interesting is the Egyptians used flint-like knives. It looked more like glass, but a lot of knives which are considered to be very, very precise. I actually watched this program. I might have posted on Facebook as well. I watched this program about surgeons that use Egyptian tools to do incisions and so on, because these tools have less friction and less dents and damages and little breaks on the blade itself. I mean, you see, for example, a metal blade, a scalpel, you think it's perfect, but actually when you put it down a microphone, it's very rigid on the microscopical level and makes cuts which are not considered to be 100% clean. While these glass-like material have less ridges, are very smooth, and then therefore have less possibility of being infected and also make smoother cuts. So stone vessels were used then, and flint. We find flint, for example, also later on with Joshua and the Israelites at Gilgad, that they actually take, he makes charavot surim, he actually makes flint knives. So it seems to be that they were very, very traditional, even though they would have had copper knives or bronze knives and maybe metal knives at one point. There was this tradition to do it with flint. So this might be this tradition as well. So she took a tzol, she took a flint. And it's also very easy to make a knife out of flint. It's a type of stone that has more of a volcanic quality to it. It's more glossy. So it says, "Vatichrot et orlat bena." She cut off the foreskin of her son. "Vatagal leraglav," and he touched his feet. So feet, seems to be the feet is actually the feet of Moses. "Vatomer ki hatan dami matali." She says, "For you," and she said, "For you are a groom, a blood groom to me." Now, this concept of blood groom, the word chatan sometimes appears as in Akkadian as chatanu, which means to protect. So you are a protected blood person to me. It seems to be that she made an incantation here. It wasn't just words. She's actually making incantations, saying, puts the blood on him or smears the blood on him and says, "You are protected by this blood." So it diffuses the situation. It says, "Vayiref mimeno," and he let go of him. "Az amar," then she said, "Chatan damim lamulot," a protection of blood by circumcision. Some people argue that this is really a breakdown of actually something much longer that she said. Either it did or didn't. There's no actual way of proving or disproving any of this. Okay, so she does kind of a ceremony here. Again, she's not an Israelite, so for her to do some kind of a ceremony like this is not something supposed to surprise us. Also, these were desert dwellers, so they were very aware of the concepts of demons and things that can harm you at night and so on. So this must be something she probably learned or was common folklore amongst her people. Now, as far as I can tell, I don't go all the way. I actually had the idea. Yeah, my original idea was actually to stop here, verse 26, because the end of chapter 4 really goes into chapter 5. So I'm just checking this to see what I decide to do here. Yeah, I think we'll stop here with the chapter because it kind of continues already into another story. So it's better we do this. So what we'll do is we'll continue next week this section. Okay, so I'm stopping the sharing. And I want to see very quickly, because Rick sent me a comment here, a long one. So let's see what Rick sent here. Okay. So Rick says the following. Moses was hiding out in Midian in fear for his life. Jethro was a priest and as such would have many visitors. If Moses had lived and dressed as a Hebrew, word would have gotten back to Pharaoh that a Hebrew was living in Midian. Not necessarily, but okay. Pharaoh might have checked it out. Again, not necessarily. To see if that Hebrew was Moses, he must have maintained his Egyptian identity because he revealed that he was a Hebrew, his life would have been in jeopardy. There's actually a fundamental flaw here with your argument, I'll point out in a second. This may be the reason why Moses did not circumcise his son. This is more evidence for my theory that his crime of murder was ever before him. I don't think this is evidence of the ever crime of murder, but I think that, yes, I mean, I agree with you that it's quite possible that the crime of murder was vexing him throughout his entire life. However, I would have actually argued the exact opposite. If he would have kept an Egyptian persona where he kept Egyptian clothing, then people would have said, "Oh, look, there's an Egyptian living in Midian." That would have caused Pharaoh to go, "Huh." Because if it were a Hebrew, if he were dressed like a Hebrew or dressed like someone who's a desert dweller, it would have meant anything. Because people run away. Pharaoh would have even cared if there's someone who looks like a Hebrew living in Egypt. It would have meant absolutely nothing. But for an Egyptian to show up in Midian, which is kind of, you're an Egyptian, what are you doing with these sheep herders? That would have actually could have caused Pharaoh to kind of raise an eyebrow. So I would argue the exact opposite. I think for him to take the persona of a Hebrew, which were anyhow nomads and semi-nomads, would have made a lot more sense than for him to keep a persona of an Egyptian. However, why he did him circumcise? Again, as I said, this is a plot hole, so I'm not too sure. But I think it would be the exact opposite. Cindy is saying, would you agree that Zipporah did a righteous thing by circumcising their son? Again, her purpose here was to protect her husband. So I don't know if it's a question of intent here. Did she do a righteous thing? Yeah, she should have circumcised her son because her son is a Hebrew. But would you say that this is a mitzvah, that she fulfilled a mitzvah by doing this? The answer is no. Her intent was more in the sense of, her intent will be more in the sense of using the foreskin as a protective element. It's more witchcraft than anything else. So again, we have to remember something. Someone could do something, a good deed, but their intent kind of gets sometimes in the way. So I don't know if we can say it's a righteous thing, but obviously the end result is that she did a thing which was correct to do. Carla says, did Moses perhaps delay circumcising the son due to the travel plans? We don't have any indication of how old the son was. He might have been quite a grown child. We have no way of knowing. It's clear that the Midianites didn't circumcise their children. That's what it seems to be. The question that's raised here is, again, why didn't Moses circumcise? I mean, they were living in this town or wherever they were living. It seems to be that he knew who he was. So why would he circumcise unless it was against the ways of the Midianites? Again, these are plot holes, and they're literally, I don't think there are any clear answers. I mean, people have been combing this material for thousands of years trying to explain this. And I don't think there's any clear answer. This is just a given. Take it as a fact. So I will tell you, I do recommend looking at this chapters 3 and 4 in the Midrashim. There's a lot of interesting stuff there. There's a lot of interesting concepts there. And what I'm doing at the moment, parallel to everything I have to do with school and so on, I'm also studying a book about Midrashim. There's a lot of interesting stuff there. And one of the claims that I keep on hearing by some experts that I know is that the Midrashim actually carry with them a lot of historical data, that there's stuff there that might shed some light about the intention of the writers that might have been passed on from word of mouth that appear in the Midrash. The Midrash are not necessarily completely detached from historical material, but they're actually connected to something else. You have to remember that the Torah, the Bible was transmitted throughout the centuries, and it's quite possible that someone somewhere knew some of the intent and some of the ideas. So I highly recommend, you can find Midrashim online, so it's not a very difficult thing to do. In any case, I am assuming there are no more questions here. So that ends the recording for this week, the 9th of August, 2015. Okay, don't go away.